Now, which is why I have sought contact with people like Alex and Stefano Fusi, which is how I ended up here. And as I sort of follow the work of people like yourselves, I see that the work at the micro level concerned with the neuron and basic arborization, and the work at what I call mid-level architectures of the sort that Stefano was talking about, basic circuitry of working memory, is sort of premised on the tacit or maybe not so tacit assumption of sort of scalable homogeneity. And that assumption works up to a point, but we know that the brain is not an entirely homogeneous system, and that anyone who, like myself, works with the effects of brain lesions know that lesions in different parts of the brain produce vastly different effects. Functional heterogeneity of the brain often declares itself most loudly at the macroscopic level of analysis, when you look at the relations between macroscopic structures. Now, and of course, like all of you, people like I would like to see some kind of an integration of these different scales, micro scale, mid scale, and macro scale, into kind of a single coherent inquiry. But the problem often arises that kind of the levels of languages of discourse are not very compatible. The kind of language that psychologists and cognitive scientists often use to characterize the functional properties of the brain at this macro level does not lend itself usually to an easy translation into your kind of parlance, and so this integration may be difficult, okay? So I've spent a fair amount, and that's a shame. So I have spent a fair amount of my own kind of effort trying to understand various various interactions at the macro level such as the interaction between the cortex and the thalamus, interaction between the prefrontal cortex and the posterior cortex, between the hippocampi and the posterior cortex, between the ventral brainstem arousal systems and the cortex, in terms which would sort of lend themselves more readily to some kind of a interface with the mid-level of analysis, ideally looking for ways to create some formalisms some of these more macroscopic properties could be grafted on the mid-level models of the sort that Stefano Fusi is developing. Now, and what I would like to talk about today is one of these kinds of efforts of mine pertaining to hemispheric specialization. So consider everything I've said so far kind of a preamble, kind of explaining my general motivation, and consider that which I'm going to talk about from this point onward sort of an example of the kind of work that we're trying to do. So hemispheric specialization, of course, everybody has heard and has been taught that the two hemispheres are different, and the traditional point of view is that the one is in charge of language and the other one is in charge of nonverbal processes, possibly visuospatial processes. And for many years, this assumption sort of was tolerated in conjunction with another assumption, namely of sort of the structural symmetry of the two hemispheres, and that was kind of a common sense defying assumption, how that two identical structures would somehow produce vastly different functions. So over the last several decades, attempts have been made to find some structural differences between the two hemispheres. And they were motivated indeed by the desire to find some structural differences which could explain possibly the functional difference whereby one hemisphere is linguistic, the other one is not. And now, is there a point? Is this our pointer? Yeah. Okay. Good. Yep. And so. Various such differences have been found. Now, one of such differences is Jacob-Levian torque. I don't know how many of you know what it is. I mean, the brain is not like this, it is like this, the two hemispheres, in that the right frontal lobe is somewhat extended over the left frontal lobe, and this is slightly wider, and the left occipital, I misspoke, I should have said right frontal pole. And the left occipital pole is somewhat extended over the right occipital pole and is slightly wider. So, and this asymmetry, gross structural asymmetry, is known as Jacob-Levian torque. It was described by a Harvard anatomist, Jacob-Lev. So this is one such asymmetry. The cortical thickness, at least in males, seems to be, and particularly in the frontal lobes, seems to be greater in the right frontal lobe than in the left frontal lobe. Planum temporale and frontal operculum, the two structures, one sitting in somewhere here and extending on the mesial surface, and planum temporale and the frontal operculum seem to be larger in the left hemisphere than in the right hemisphere. And these are the findings, in fact, which created, when they were first reported by Norman Geschwind, a lot of jubilation, because it seemed that they could explain these functional differences whereby the left hemisphere is in charge of language and the right hemisphere is not. Spindle cells, the cells whose cell bodies are found in the frontal lobes mostly, and Hussein talking about long axons, Hussein these long axons back, appear to be asymmetric in their distribution. There are considerably many more of them in the right frontal lobe than in the left frontal lobe, by about one third, big difference. Now, the neuromodulator distribution, nor the adrenergic pathways seem to be favor ever so slightly the right hemisphere, and the dopaminergic pathways seem to favor ever so slightly the left hemisphere. And of course, these two types of modulation are very different. One is more phasic and more restricted. The dopaminergic modulation is more restricted both temporally and spatially, and noradrenergic modulation is more widespread both temporally and spatially. So people began to report various structural and biochemical differences between the two hemispheres. But the catch was that none of these differences was unique to humans. Okay, they were observed across certainly across the primates, but even outside of the primate world in many various rodent species. Okay, so there goes this notion that one hemisphere is in charge of language and the other one is in charge of visual spatial processes. This functional distinction is sort of is meaningless outside of our species, and it's entirely possible that that it is a special case, in us. But it has to be a special case of some broad, more fundamental functional difference between the two hemispheres, which would be equally applicable through the evolution of all these creatures who exhibit these structural differences. Okay, so I've been very interested in trying to identify those, or at least putatively, identify those more fundamental underlying functional differences between the two hemispheres. I would like to talk about it, and then maybe talk about, again, very speculatively, about the structural differences, architectural differences, which would make these functional differences possible as emergent properties. Now, for reasons which I will not belabor at length, but prompted by some clinical observations made long time ago, which compared the effects of lesions, similar anatomically similar lesions in children and in adults, we came upon this notion that the right hemisphere may be critical for dealing with novel information, and the left hemisphere may be critical for dealing in terms of processing in reliance on well-established cognitive routines. Now, and of course, it's not a binary distinction. I mean, it's a continuum of cognitive novelty versus cognitive routinization. But the advantage of this notion is that it basically is meaningful potentially with respect to any creature capable of learning and is not limited to our own species. Now, when we began to look for evidence in and this is just a kind of a very conceptual kind of a diagram representing this notion that when an organism endowed with the two hemispheres is exposed to some cognitive task which is initially novel, then the right hand, it is not a parametric graph, it's kind of a loose conceptual graph. The right hemisphere is the one which takes the lead in processing this information, but when in the kind of a in due time this type of cognitive task becomes familiar, the left hemisphere begins to exhibit the kind of a superior command over this task and control over this task. And I'll show it in a second. Now, and before we review the evidence, which will be the content of the content of the next half a dozen slides, let me just point out to you something that has been known about the two neuromodulators that I mentioned earlier, that norepinephrine, which seems to be more prolific in the right hemisphere, also is such that if you stimulate noradrenergic pathways in the rat, you enhance orienting behavior. Kind of a novel... that order of magnitude, I don't remember it exactly. It's the work to a large extent by Stanley Glick at Mount Sinai in New York, and it can all be looked up, but I don't remember it off the top of my head. And now, we're not talking about that order of magnitude, right? And by contrast, when the dopaminergic pathways are stimulated and they are somewhat more prolific in the left hemisphere, this results in the enhancement of stereotypic behaviors. In other words, kind of engaging in highly familiar, routinized behaviors. So this behavioral pharmacology evidence basically comports with what I said earlier. Now, more direct cognitive evidence. And much of what I'm going to show here is not our own work, but some is. And much of this work, much of what I'm going to show here, is in fact incidental, a collection of incidental findings obtained by various people while looking for something else. All right. And I'll break it up just for the ease of discussion into short-term effect, short-term timescale effects, and long-term effects. So let's start with those. Suppose you create a situation where you introduce your subject to a cognitively novel task, recognizing some weird polygons or something of that nature. And you create an experiment where you create several hundred somewhat similar trials, and which may last an hour or 2 hours. And you run the subject through this exercise, and you look at the change in the hemispheric dominance at different stages of this process. Invariably, this pattern reveals itself, whereby the right hemisphere seems to be more proficient at early stages, and the left hemisphere at late stages. And that is true even for linguistic stimuli, which, according to this kind of more orthodox point of view, are supposed to sit in an inviolate fashion in the left hemisphere. But if you create a verbal task which is novel, I look at the word and decide whether it works with boo or something like that, something that you don't usually do with language, then at early stages it will exhibit this kind of particular affinity for the right hemisphere. Now, and likewise, if you create a task which, according to kind of a more orthodox point of view, is supposed to sit in an inviolable way, inviolate way in the left hemisphere. It turns out in the right hemisphere, various visuospatial discriminations, then it turns out that as the subject becomes familiar with this type of task, it somehow migrates to the left hemisphere. These look at the dates, look at the chronology. On this slide, we have some sort of plusquamperfectum work, right? The work conducted long time ago, using various low-tech devices like tachistoscopes or dichotic listeners. The next slide shows more recent work. Tachistoscope, yeah, it's a low-tech device which was used by cognitive scientists before various functional neuroimaging devices became available. People stopped using them maybe in the 80s, early 90s with the advent of PET. Not quite. You put the subject, it's not used anymore, but a lot of useful data were generated with these devices. You put the subject in front of a light box, in effect, have the subject fixate on a central fixation point, and meanwhile flash various visual stimuli at certain visual angles at very brief exposures, maybe 50 milliseconds, that order of magnitude. The assumption being that a stimulus thus delivered is processed mostly in the contralateral hemisphere. And as I said, nobody today uses these technologies, but believe it or not, that's what I used to do at the Rockefeller University in the late 70s. So then it was kind of a state-of-the-art stuff. But this is much more, again, if you look at these dates, these are much more recent dates. Okay, yeah. And basically they show the same, not everything that's old is wrong, you see. So in fact, these findings were confirmed with the kind of imaging technology that we use today with PET and functional MRI more recently. You see that, and the paradigm is essentially the same. You create a task which is novel, and there are many trials, and the subject is put through this exercise, and you can image, of course, with much greater precision than with these old devices. You can see which parts of the brain are activated, and what you see is that this kind of a gradual drift of the locus of cortical control, if you will, from the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere, as the subject becomes increasingly familiar with the task. And again, this novelty routine versus a familiarity variable appears to override other variables. It's true for verbal tasks, it's true for non-verbal tasks. It appears to be kind of the dominant factor which determines which hemisphere sort of mediate the task. And this is some of our own work with fMRI in collaboration with Kai Fogelei in Germany, where we ask the subject to look at various visual arrays and pay attention either to similarity or to dissimilarity. And when you ask the subject to pay attention to similarity between these items in the visual array, you get the pattern of activation captured with green. And we ask the subject to look for dissimilarity, you get the pattern of activation captured with blue. Again, depending on whether you add the subject to attend to the familiar or to the novel, you get these opposite patterns of activation. Let me just put it all at once. Yeah. Do anything else? No. And this is the work done also in collaboration with some Japanese colleagues, Masai Aihara and his colleagues. And this is kind of the natural history of a task. Again, it's a perception, and this is not fMRI. This is high resolution EEG looking at gamma frequency 30 to 40 hertz. And this this kind of frequency has been used by many people as a marker of kind of a strenuous mental effort, all right? So again, this is kind of a natural history of a task, and the task becomes familiar over a course of something like 50 or 60 trials. There is this gradual drift of the locus of activation from the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere. Yeah. Well, it does both. You see, you're absolutely right. It's a two-dimensional shift. It does shift from right to left, but it also shifts from front to back. That's a separate story. But there is a preferential relationship between the prefrontal cortex and novelty also. Yeah. So really the shift is a two-dimensional shift, but right now we're talking about one of these two dimensions, but we are aware of its two-dimensional nature, and both dimensions of the shift are informative, right? Yeah. Now, this is kind of a grand total for all of 50 or 60 trials. I think there were 50 trials in this experiment, okay? Now, this answers your question maybe more directly. This is a kind of a natural history of a single trial, okay? And look at what happens. This picture is the average, what they did, and what we did, what they did, they split up the sequence of, let's say, 60 trials into the first half and the second half, and averaged within each of these halves. And so this captures what happens during a single trial early in this sequence. And what happens that when the subject first, and there was certain decision making in this experiment, which I'm not going to belabor. But when the subject first encounters the stimulus and has to decide which of these two to select, the right prefrontal cortex lights up, and then the kind of a center of cognitive gravity, if you will, shifts to the occipital parietal regions and visual regions. Now, in the second, toward the end of the sequence, you still have this relationship within each trial that at early stage in a given trial the frontal lobe lights up, and at late stage the occipital parietal regions light up. But now it's no longer the right frontal lobe, it's left frontal lobe. You see what I'm saying? So this answers your question. Say it again? Correct. And the first one was the first half of block of trials, and this is the average. This is averaged across individual trials. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is basically similar using beta frequency, so I will skip it. And now, so what we have looked at so far was short timescale evidence that, obtained in experiments lasting to the order of maybe minutes or hours. And so now let's look at long-term evidence, which may capture some changes which develop over years. And this was a very kind of one of the early experiments which sort of defied one of the traditional neurological assumptions, namely that music processing of music is somehow mediated by the right hemisphere. In fact, any traditional kind of a neurology textbook will tell you that amusia is caused by damage to the right hemisphere. Well, yes and no. Two groups of subjects were compared, musically naive people like most of us, musically naive meaning not musically trained people like most of us, most of humanity, versus a bunch of Juilliard students, a bunch of professional musicians or graduate students in music, they found this disparity that indeed in musically naive people, indeed a task involving musical discrimination engaged the right hemisphere, but in these musically trained musicians, it engaged the left hemisphere. Okay, the same was obtained when familiar and unfamiliar faces were compared. Again, prosopagnosia, that deficit of facial recognition, has been traditionally regarded as a consequence of right hemisphere, right parietal damage, right temporal parietal damage. Any neurology textbook will tell you so. Yes, but no. Again, it's true for unfamiliar faces or relatively unfamiliar faces. In other words, I don't know any of you. I don't have the habit of beholding your faces for a very long time. I met you over the last few days. So if some kind of a facial discrimination task were to be constructed using your faces, it would probably activate predominantly activate the right temporal parietal regions. But if a similar in the design task were to involve, I know, faces who stare at me from the front page of the New York Times every day, whoever these people may be, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, whoever populate the front pages of the New York Times these days, it will probably engage my left temporal parietal regions. So, if you look at normal development, it appears that even those aspects of cognition, which by traditional kind of a reckoning were supposed to be affiliated with the left hemisphere in an absolute kind of an inviolate fashion like language, at early stages exhibit, at least certain aspects of language, exhibit this pattern of right hemispheric preference. If you look at the effects of brain lesions inflicted early in life, then it turns out that early damage to the right hemisphere, by early I mean first years of life, will interfere with the subsequent acquisition of language, and the adverse impact of this effect will diminish with the age of will be inversely related to the age of lesion onset. Okay, which means that, you know, the right hemisphere does play a role in language acquisition at early stages, but its contribution kind of diminishes over time. Now, and then, so okay. So I hope that this answers your question about evidence. So there is such evidence coming from various technologies. And that sort of leads to a provocative possibility that long-term memory is associated somehow, is stored to a greater extent, and of course we resort to these binary contrasts for kind of a as conceptual shorthands. Of course, everybody understands that. In reality, each hemisphere is capable of doing the function of the other, but we're talking about relatively subtle kind of a preference. So with this understanding, when I say that one hemisphere does this and the other hemisphere does that, it has to be understood that I don't mean it in such absolute binary terms. But it leads, with this caveat, it leads to an interesting possibility that long-term memory maybe somehow is mediated by the left hemisphere more than by the right hemisphere for all kinds of information, not just verbal. And I got the first inkling of that in a way which actually, this is a very old paper, it was published almost 30 years ago, and in those days, today, virtually every issue of Science or Nature contains something on cognitive neuroscience. In those days, we were supposed to be off limit. We were not supposed to be part of legitimate science. So, but they published this paper, and basically it was it was a single case study to boot, which is totally out of character for Science magazine, was a single case study of a man who suffered brain damage in a traumatic brain injury in a horse riding accident and developed profound retrograde amnesia. He lost much, not all, but much of his memories for his past, for the events and the knowledge acquired before the onset of brain damage, both of verbal and non-verbal nature. And I was very, you know, I felt very bothered by the fact that basically and it was caused, as we sort of concluded, by this lesion sitting in the ventral tegmental area, which today is a big deal in cognitive neuroscience. In those days, you know, very few people were interested in it. This lesion, and you know, today it was one of the first generation scanners. Today people would be ashamed to put up a scan like this, but that was almost 30 years ago. So this lesion extended from the pontomesencephalic junction to the ventral tegmentum, ventral tegmental area, and I was very bothered by the fact that this massive effect was produced by essentially lateralized lesion, okay? And in this science paper, I sort of basically engaged in all kinds of mental gymnastics saying that, you know, but the midline was crossed, but I knew that it was a disingenuous argument because it did cross the midline, but barely, right? Then subsequent to this observation, we studied a number of patients of various etiologies and concluded that the patterns of that retrograde amnesia was indeed was more likely to have been produced by damage to the left hemisphere than right hemisphere. These are people with temporal lobe epilepsy, and I won't bore you with these slides, but they just show what I just said with various methods. So. Well, now let's step back and sort of think about it logically. If indeed it is the case that the right hemisphere deals predominantly, somehow excels at dealing with novelty, and the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere with cognitive routines, then as we age, usually the domain of the novel shrinks and the domain of the familiar expands, and so one would think that we sort of rely increasingly on the left hemisphere and decreasingly on the right hemisphere as we age. And that sort of correlates with a very interesting observation, the kind of finding, which again, what I summarized on this in this table is a bunch of incidental findings obtained by various people while looking for something else. Okay. And there is a lot of interest, obviously, these days in brain aging. And there are all kinds of morphometric techniques used to characterize it. Volumetric techniques, voxel counting techniques, etc. And they tend to show that the left hemisphere ages less rapidly than the right hemisphere, okay? And if you do a single scientist, you will see that there are a bunch of studies pointing in this direction and zero studies pointing in the opposite direction. So if you do this kind of a simple meta-analysis. So the right hemisphere seems to age more rapidly than the left hemisphere. One can only speculate about the causation behind, but one possibility is that it may be due to some kind of a neuroprotective effect of activity-based neuroplasticity, whatever that means, and there may be arguments for and against this point of view. And even when people talk about this neuroplasticity, the kind of a blunt instrument that we use, MRI, cannot distinguish between whether we're talking about neurons or glia or arborization. These are macroscopic measures. Now, but over the last 10 years, there has been a whole spate of studies suggesting that that in different types of people, the parts of the brain exercised by these people, engaged by these people, by dint of their kind of a profession or whatever, are larger than in the population at large. And many of you may have heard about this study of London cab drivers with their hippocampi larger than in simple mortals. That would not have been replicated in New York cab drivers, where driving a cab is not a profession, it's kind of a stopgap between two bouts of whatever welfare. Left angular gyrus is greater in bilingual than in monolinguals. And of course, this is a primary, one of the important language areas. Herschel gyrus, which is critical for tonal discrimination in the parietal, in the temporal lobe, is larger in professional musicians than in people like us, like most of us. Correlation does not automatically point at the direction of causation, but in many of these studies, one can surmise causation. For instance, here there is a positive relationship between hippocampal size and the number of years on the job. You see what I'm saying? And that sort of suggests the directionality of causation. Here there is also a relationship, here this effect is present not only in people who acquired their second language early in life, but who, like myself, acquired their second language, you know, as adults, all right? I basically switched my linguistic environment at the age of 27. So these two points at the direction of causation, and this Herschel jars in musicians also revealed the kind of a positive correlation between the size of this effect and the amount of time spent in practicing their instrument. In other words, diligent musicians exhibited more of this effect more strongly than slovenly musicians. So and more recently, there was the study which really is unequivocal as to the direction of causation. Involving kind of amateur jugglers. What they did, they just recruited a bunch of people who had no interest in juggling, and they did some quantitative morphometry of their brains prior to enrolling them into the juggling experiment. And then for 2 or 3 months, they taught them various juggling routines, okay? And these were people like us, they were not professional jugglers. And when they then repeated these morphometric studies in them, they concluded that there was some enlargement, both in the gray matter and white matter of certain in certain regions in the temporal and parietal lobe, particularly in the parietal lobe. Yeah. So, say it again. No, that would be my prediction. I mean, the people who conducted this study did not engage in this kind of a hemispheric measurement, so I don't know. Yeah. Correct. So I enlist this information. Correct. Correct. As we age. So in effect, I enlist this information to explain that which I showed you on the previous slide. Yeah. Hmm? Say it again? Yeah. Well, that we cannot, MRI will not tell us that because it is a blunt instrument. Some people would argue, and it's a controversial point of view, that there may be new neurons, okay? There are proponents of adult neurogenesis, and I know that it's a controversial issue. MRI does not answer this question. It could be changes in arborization, it could be in principle changes in glia, or it could be changes in, or maybe even addition of new neurons. The MRI is not capable of answering this question. Hmm? Well, there have been claims made. Changes in our kind of activity-driven changes in arborization, I don't think that is controversial any longer. But what is controversial is whether there is adult lifelong neurogenesis. And there are some data, coming from Peter Erickson and people like that, that it exists in the hippocampi. There are some data that it exists in the olfactory cortex. Yeah. Now, well, so we have talked so far, I've sort of introduced this notion that really the functional difference between the two hemispheres is such that one is somehow better equipped to deal with cognitive routines and the other one is better equipped to deal with novel information. And then the question is, well, what are the structure? Can one point at least putatively at some structural differences which might account for it and point at them in such a way which would, at least in principle, enable, lend themselves to modeling which could elucidate it in maybe computer simulations or maybe through analytical modeling. This is what my reading of anatomical literature tells me, that assuming a rough equality of the cortical surface in the two hemispheres, the allocation of different types of, different resource allocation across different types of cortices. So that the left hemisphere, modality specific cortices seem to be somewhat larger than in the right hemisphere. And in the right hemisphere, heteromodal cortices seem to be somewhat larger than in the left hemisphere. What do I mean by heteromodal cortices? Inferotemporal, infraparietal, frontopolar, and dorsolateral. Okay? So this is one kind of architectural difference which appears to characterize the two hemispheres. The other one relates to pathways. As I said earlier, there are some ample data, or at least some data, that these long pathways, like the ones emanating from spindle cells, are more prolific in the right hemisphere than in the left hemisphere. Whereas the short non-myelinated pathways may be more prolific in the left hemisphere than in the right hemisphere. So there are differences in pathway architecture. And the third one is differences in neuromodulation. As I said earlier, the right hemisphere favors noradrenergic modulation, the left hemisphere favors dopaminergic modulation. So the question is basically we're not talking about two vastly different neural architectures. We're talking about two variations on basically the same theme, but two different variations, okay? And then the question is whether these two variations would lend themselves differentially to this kind of a better ability to deal with novel information versus the ability to somehow operate with reliance on previously formed representation. And this is something that we may attempt to actually model with people in New York and see what happens. Now, another interesting possibility, well, actually, maybe let me stop here. How are we doing on time, more or less?
You want to take a few more minutes?
Yeah. Another interesting possibility sort of emanates from the work of Eric Kandel. And again, I know that not everybody agrees with it, but he claimed that in mammalians, long-term memory formation is somehow mediated by dopamine as a modulator, okay? Something that he claims is unique to mammalians, and in his invertebrate models, it's not dopamine, it's serotonin. Now, and if that is so, then that may have something to do with this fact that long-term memories seem to populate the left hemisphere more than the right hemisphere. In effect, what we're trying to do is to sort of formulate these macro. I'm just concluding. Our understanding of these macroscopic differences between macroscopic heterogeneity, which in the brain, in terms which would lend itself to modeling and would make it compatible with the language that, that people operating at your level, at your kind of levels of molarity, so that some kind of an integration might be possible. I mean, there's a general kind of a sentiment in the field that our attempt to understand how these mechanisms operate should proceed along the bottom-up kind of a path. But maybe it might benefit from a bidirectional assault, both bottom-up and also using some constraints which emanate from the understanding of this macro architecture. Okay, thank you. Say it again. Well, from the point of view of optimality, well, some of the people of your ilk, like Steven Grossberg, whose name was mentioned earlier, has claimed many years ago that a computationally efficient network should separate the machinery of dealing with novel information from the machinery of conserving previously acquired knowledge. Correct. Correct. So to the extent... Correct, yeah. And... Why is it not larger? But in reality, these anatomical differences and biochemical differences are not huge, but they are not infinitesimal either. That's a very interesting question. These studies, there have been many attempts to relate hemispheric specialization to handedness. And they basically failed because kind of a simple double dissociation would imply that whatever the pattern of functional lateralization is in right-handers, it should be the inverse of that in left-handers. That does not obtain, okay? Now, and because of that, people even concluded that there is no direct relationship. Now, these data, and then from this point on, I can continue to sort of respond to your question speculatively or empirically. Let me start empirically. And the data are mushy because the left-handedness may be a product of two things. One which we call natural left-handedness, kind of a genetically determined left-handedness. The other one is so-called pathological left-handedness, and that is the transfer of handedness as a result of some kind of perinatal brain damage. And that may happen to both to right-handers and to left-handers, of course, but because of the unequal base rate of right-handers to left-handers, 10 to 1, there are many more pathological left-handers than right-handers, okay? In most studies which try to relate cognition to handedness, these pathological handedness were not removed, left-handers were not removed from the sample. Well, usually this chance. And that, and we have, and I can comment on that also. Now, of course, in our species, the majority of individuals are right-handed. In various other primate species, you can also talk about handedness or call it pawedness, okay, in the sense that there is a consistent use of one hand at the one paw, the main paw, and the other one, the supporting one. So individual specimens do have handedness, but this population-wide, this split is much closer to 50-50, okay? Now, many years ago, Mortimer Mishkin, Carl Pribram, conducted an experiment, in effect, looking at the, similar to the kind of work that we are doing in monkeys, looking for the propensity toward novelty versus propensity toward similar. I mean, they were shown something and then they had to choose between an identical object and a different object, and both were baited, okay? And so they looked for these kind of preferences. And they concluded that the preferences were roughly divided in a 50-50 fashion. Somewhat similar experiments in humans, which we conducted, yielded a vastly asymmetric picture. We are a very conservative species, more conservative than our monkey brethren. Okay. Now, I tried to get a hold of these old Mishkin's data by calling Mort Mishkin, and needless to say, they didn't pay attention to the monkey's poorness, okay? But I would bet you that had they paid attention to it, they would have found out a relationship between monkey-handedness and this propensity toward conservatism versus novelty, which basically would go along with what I've been proposing here, some kind of preferential association between the right hemisphere and novelty. Seeking, you know, and that may relate to what you said. Yeah. Correct. And our own work has shown in some simple response selection preference experiments shown that whereas right-handers were uniformly conservative, left-handers, there was a large subset among left-handers who exhibited this kind of a preference toward novelty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Well, that's not correct. You can. People who suffered left hemispherectomy, which is sometimes done to treat intractable seizures, as infants learn language. Yeah, eventually. In effect, for all practical purposes, indistinguishably from people with their whole brains intact. I mean, you can demonstrate some cognitive limitations only in a very subtle way through all kinds of special tests, but at least at a course level, they do as well as any of us. Yeah. And bilinguals continue to rely to some degree on the right hemisphere insofar as their second language goes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Reminds me that one day we had a black bottle by someone.